Mormon Stories is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormonstories.org and clicking on the donate button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Stories are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support.
Circling gloom, lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home. Lead thou.
Okay, so let's just step back and, you know, there's a discussion board called Mormon Discussions. There's also one called Mormon Apologetic Dialogue or something like that. I think it's been called the Mad Board. But there's this whole underground of sort of Mormon scholars, Mormon critics, Mormon apologists. And if you go to any of these boards at any given time, there's just volumes of text being written about all sorts of history and controversy and scholarship around Mormon studies. It's a real fascinating and vibrant subculture. And I know that you've had your own interactions with the likes of Daniel Peterson and Lou Midgley and others over the years. And so I'm just curious if you're willing to talk about kind of when that first started and what your experience has been just personally trying to interact with Mormon apologists. And I want the conversation to kind of lead to where we are today with what's happened with Mormon apologetics over time, how have they evolved, and where are we today? And then we can talk about the future. But what are you able to talk about in terms of that history?
Well, you know, for me, the history is fairly long. You know, I remember having conversations with Dan Peterson and Stephen Ricks and Bill Hamlin for years. Decades back now. I remember going to lunch with Bill Hamlin. I want to say that David Seeley came along with us, but I may be misremembering. I'm pretty sure it was him. And he's also works in the BYU Religion Department, I believe. And, you know, we had a fairly lively discussion over the Book of Mormon, and that turned into me, you know, corresponding with him on occasion. And
when would this have been about again?
This would have been the 80s.
Okay.
And then Bill Hamlin started a listserv, which, you know, back in the day, for those who are unfamiliar with that, that is the old version of a message board for all intents and purposes, or a Facebook group. But it was all done with ASCII characters only. And so you would send off these messages to the listserv, and then they would be distributed, folks would respond. And the listserv was called Mormant, so M-O-R-M hyphen A-N-T, which stood for Mormonism and Antiquity. And When I got on there, I was definitely considered to be the black sheep of the group. And so there was a lot of dogpiling that went on during that time period. But I was up for it, and I enjoyed it and enjoyed the banter. I actually printed off, I think, the entire archive of Mormant. I've got it in a storage unit here, and it's reams and reams of paper, and eventually that went to complete meltdown when Lou Midgley came on and just went off on a tirade involving me, and I actually got banned. Bill Hamlin banned me from the forum, and it just went into complete meltdown at that point. But that ended up being shut down, and so that was in the early days, and that was also during a time right before my book New Approaches to the Book of Mormon came out, because there were some things on there, and this is where I had one of my first encounters with John Gee, where he gave a critique of a book that I had cited and a dialogue article that I had written, and he was going to publish a critique of this, and I responded to him with what I thought was a pretty deftly constructed response and explained to him what the situation was, why the person was being cited, and so on. And he never replied to me, and then just went ahead and had his critique published, even though his critique completely misrepresented my position. And I had explained it in detail, and I just, things like that were disheartening, to say the least. And so as time has gone on, I've participated in a variety of forums, and even had a really interesting exchange with Brian Hoglund at one point on the old Fair message board about the Book of Abraham, where we discussed things in considerable detail. And I enjoyed those exchanges, but as time has gone on, I've just got increasingly weary of all the white noise that's out there. And, you know, the lack of constructive civil dialogue. And I've pretty much retreated from that now. I don't have a whole lot of interest in it. I don't really follow it even that much, only to the degree that if there's something that piques my interest and it may involve some future research project, I'll certainly take a look. I want to be able to consider all types of different views on what my research involves. But as far as active participation, it's gone from being very active to being extremely inactive. And in fact, even back in the days when the Zion's Lighthouse message board was running, I was the first ex-Mormon moderator of that forum. I don't know if people even knew I was a moderator, because the majority of the moderators that we had were active LDS. And but we had a wonderful relationship among the moderators. I think we were, in fact, that was really, to me, the epitome of how a discussion should happen between believers, non-believers, and anyone in between, because I thought that we treated each other with incredible respect and civility. And even when we disagreed passionately with each other, it never became mean-spirited or personal. And I wish I could see more of that out there, but I tend to be a magnet for people who want to kind of come and be the person who responds to the new critic on the board or what have you. So I don't really participate much anymore. It doesn't really hold my interest, quite honestly.
Okay. There's something about Metcalf is butthead or something to that effect. Just tell that. Tell that story really quick, because it's mentioned like every month on one of these forums.
Right. That's the apologetic gaffe that will never go away. I think we're stuck with that for all eternity. What happened was that Bill Hamlin wrote a reply to, again, to this dialogue piece, the same one that John Gee was going to be commenting on, and if I remember correctly, the Hamlin's reply actually exceeded the length of my article. And in the reply, what he had done is he had formed an acrostic where the first letter of successive paragraphs each formed, basically made out the word, and this is not including indented quotations, right? They were left out of the acrostic, but all of the regular styled paragraphs formed the word Metcalf is butthead. And this was just something that I think that Bill thought was just incredibly funny, which I still am missing the humorous part, because Bill also created this document that somebody gave me a copy of that had something to the effect of Dan Vogel and Brent Metcalf are the Beavis and Butthead of Mormon studies. And that sentence was repeated over and over again, I think over the course of about 6 to 10 pages. And then footnotes are being given referencing something like the Journal of Beavis and Butthead Studies. And that's all this document was. And which I found, quite frankly, to be a little bizarre. And evidently he distributed it to a few of his students at BYU, and eventually it ended up getting back to me. Then, you know, he gave an apology on an email, and at one point about it, only for me to find out that within a day or two after that, he showed up at his farm's board meeting where wearing a Beavis and Butthead t-shirt, much to the delight of evidently many of the board members. And the way that the acrostic was actually discovered is that I had found out through some people at BYU that he had done this. And I was on the phone one night with Scott Falbring, who was doing work with farms at the time, and I told him about it. I said, do you know that the next journal, the next review of books on the Book of Mormon that comes out is going to have this acrostic in it? And he was mortified. He could not believe it. And so he got on the phone after I talked to him and started making phone calls. And they were recalling issues. They stripped covers off printed volumes, reprinted some of the pages, rebound them. But they did this, evidently, and this is something that I found out years later, before they could get to all of them. Because, as it turns out, some of the, they had already given out earlier versions. For example, Bill Hamlin has said that he has a version with the acrostic still in it. And so other members of the board and so on had already received theirs. But the mailings had also already begun. And so evidently there was a woman in California who received a copy. And years later, Kurt Bench, who's a friend of mine and a collector of Mormon documents and a seller of books and rare books and so on, purchased the copy and let me make copies of all the pages. So I actually have photographic images of the entire acrostic that spells out Metcalf is butthead. So this notion that it was caught and never published, which Dan Peterson has repeated more times than I can count, is utter nonsense. It in fact was published, and some of the books were actually distributed and sent out. So if anyone ever sees Dan Peterson, say again, as he has many times on different forums until I've confronted him on it, that they were never distributed and it was not formally published that way and it was removed, he's simply wrong. And he knows it. I mean, quite honestly, he knows it. And I've got the proof of it right on my hard drive with images of all the pages. But I think it was a really puerile act that, you know, they effectively turned what should have been a scholarly journal into a bathroom wall. And it's it was just a really juvenile behavior on their part. And hopefully somebody in there has learned their experience. But now, having said that, everything has come full circle, right? Because now Hamlin and Peterson are increasingly marginalized by Mormon scholars and even other Mormon apologists who take a very scholarly bent approach to Mormonism. They are now Hamlin, Peterson, and those of their ilk are finding themselves increasingly on the outskirts of Mormon studies rather than in the midst of them.
And what do you make of that? Like, what do you make of, you know, do you have any particular feelings about or opinions about the former Maxwell Institute? You know, what happened with Daniel Peterson, like, and Lou Midgley and Greg Smith and others? You know, how do you make sense of that? And do you have any particular, you know, thoughts or reactions to that? What happened there, you know, a year or two ago?
Well, I have no, you know, firsthand knowledge of any of it, and I'm not going to pretend to have any sources that have really filled me in, because, to be honest with you, at a certain level, I really don't care. And but I will say that I think redecoration of the house, so to speak, at the Maxwell Institute has probably been...
Wait, the what? The what?
The redecoration of the house, so to speak, where remodeled and... I don't want to say that they've torn down the house and built a new one, but they've certainly done some fairly serious remodeling. And I would say that the changes that they have made, in all honesty, for the spiritual health and intellectual health of the church moving forward, they've made, in my opinion, some very positive moves. And that's not to say that that's because they're coming closer to the way I think about things. That's not it at all. I think that they're just trying to get into a direction where they're getting specialists in their individual fields to address very specific issues as openly and as honestly as they can. And I think that for the longevity of the Maxwell Institute, and especially in the internet era, apologists could get away with a whole lot in the past. When Hugh Nibley was writing, he could get away with so much. And at the age of the internet, you cannot pull the wool over people's eyes. And you have to be very careful how you tread. And I think that the changes that the Maxwell Institute have made will go a long way to try and rectify that situation and try and come up with a more transparent approach to history and belief. That's my take anyway. And again, I'm just giving you an opinion here. I don't have any firsthand insider knowledge of any of this.
Sure. Sure. Okay. What do you, you know, what do you think, and I've asked you this several times, both with historical figures and modern ones, but like, have you ever had a talk with any of these guys and ever tried to figure out how they do what they do? You know what I'm saying? Because they can't find any credible, you know, scientists outside of sort of the LDS Church payroll, you know, to validate any of their work. And yet they keep plugging.
Well, let me give you two examples that I know. One is a person who, very prominent Mormon apologist for Farms. I'm not going to give their name, and out of respect for them, but I know that this person, while in his PhD program, it came to say it was a crisis of faith is an understatement. In his mind, he was left with one of two choices, that he either become an atheist or he just take a massive leap of faith and embrace Mormonism as true, irrespective of evidence. And he chose the latter. But he was absolutely entertaining the notion, you know, he was at a point where he could not justify the existence of God. And rather than go down the atheist path and the atheist journey, he chose to make a leap of faith that he knew would force him to suspend his own judgments on scholarship and how it pertained to the truthfulness of Mormonism. You know, Carrie Mullistein has just recently published a piece on the Book of Abraham where he talks about assumptions that scholars bring to the study of the Book of Abraham. And he says right up front that my assumption is that the Book of Abraham is true, and by true, he's saying it's a translation of Egyptian, and that this is how we got the text, and so on. The problems with that are just innumerable in my mind, because one, what he's really saying is that he's not beginning with the assumption that the Book of Abraham is true in some cosmic sense, but rather that his interpretation of how the Book of Abraham is true is what is true. In other words, he's not distinguishing a truth claim from his own interpretation that leads to that truth claim. And really what he's saying is my, I begin with my assumption. Well, the fact is that there are many of us who have begun with the assumption that the Book of Abraham may be this or that, but we've also been open to the idea that learning more can in fact help refine and craft our assumptions into things that may be different than what we had previously thought. That to me is what scholarship does. What Carrie Mullistein describes in this essay of his that was just recently published in the Meridian magazine, I guess he gave a version of it as at the FAIR conference, the FAIR Mormon conference. What Carrie Mullistein describes is the antithesis of scholarship. It's everything we should not want to be doing. In other words, we don't concoct our own illusions of what we consider to be a truth claim, what we consider to be the criteria on which we are going to judge whether or not something is true or false. But we allow our assumptions to be molded and to be refined and in some cases even undermined by new discovery and new evidence. That's what scholarship is about to me. And that is the distinction, I suppose, between a path where here he has clearly delineated the apologist path. And I'm trying to say that the critical scholar's path is something very different than that, because it allows for the realization that those assumptions that we start with are in fact interpretations. They're our interpretations, and they are subject to revision just like any other interpretation we may have. I would expect that folks would hold my research and my analyses to a rigorous standard and not give me a pass because I'm a believer or a non-believer. Just because there may be those who have doubts about the truthfulness of Mormonism, that doesn't justify them in just taking me at my word. You should be every bit as rigorous in critiquing my arguments and beliefs as you would the apologist's arguments and beliefs.
Sure. Okay. So overall, you see the changes, changes with the Maxwell Institute as positive ones, right?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I do. And again, it's not because I see them as, kind of slowly moving in my direction at all. I just think that they're bringing a wide variety of talent and refreshing ideas to the discussion of Mormon studies. And we're kind of, changing of the guard, if you will. It's time to move on to bigger and better things. And there is a whole dynamic, refreshing way of viewing religion as a whole and as well as society that the scholars that they are employing will bring that, I think, to the discussion.
Sure. Okay. All right. So do you feel like over time apologists are just sort of destined to lose?
Do you
see them retreating, over time?
I see the apologetics changing. And that is that, David Wright, the friend of mine who was excommunicated along with me as a result of our contributions to new approaches to the Book of Mormon, David had written a piece on what he described as a post-critical apologetic. And, of course, that incurred the wrath of folks like Bill Hamlin and others. But what David foresaw in that article is something that I think we'll see as an adjustment going forward. It's not so much that apologists are destined to lose, as that certain types of apologetics are going to become antiquated. And that's what I see happening now, is that there are already certain types of apologetic arguments that simply are not going to survive a rigorous analysis. They just simply aren't. And that's already underway. And the Book of Abraham is a good example. If somebody is going to argue that the Book of Abraham contains traditions about Abraham that were not known in the early 19th century, and then they bring together these different works that have been put out by Farms in support of this, they failed already. Because I can show that, in fact, that is not the case. That, in fact, some of these traditions were not simply known in Joseph Smith's era, but arguably widely known in Joseph Smith's era. And so, again, those are types of arguments that I think are just simply going to be obsolete in a matter of a decade or so, if even that.
Sure. Okay. Well, I guess, do you follow people like Richard Bushman and Terrell Givens and, David Bolkovoy, Adam Miller? Do you follow kind of this new generation, old/new generation of Mormon apologists?
Well, it's interesting that you would say that, because there's actually a comparison to be made there. And that is that when I look at, say, a Richard Bushman or a Leonard Arrington, who's now deceased, these were folks who understood some of the complexities of history and so on for decades. And I think that they have taken a different approach, a more nuanced approach to a defense of the faith. And so that's kind of what I'm talking about, that we're seeing that come more to the forefront. I mean, I've read some of the works of all the authors that you've mentioned. I think that there's still considerable refinement to happen, you know, as time goes on. I think that they're bright, talented people, and have obviously enormous amounts to contribute and have already contributed, you know, significant amounts to our understanding. But the path is still ahead. And there's a lot of underbrush that needs to be cut off in front of us as we move forward. So yeah, I don't think we're there yet, but eventually, I suppose. But again, that's just my opinion.
So where can you see apologetics going in the future? That's sort of salvageable. And what, well, can the church? You know, the church is clearly trying to make some headway with these essays. Overall, just what's your take of the essays overall? Not just the Book of Abraham, but the essays, you know, First Vision, you know, the kind of the polygamy that doesn't involve Nauvoo, you know, all the essays, DNA in the Book of Mormon. What do you make of the essays overall?
Well, I think for many people, at least, you know, friends that I've talked to who are both LDS, non-LDS, some have described them as, you know, tremendous leaps forward. Whereas I kind of view them, and I don't want to sound too uncharitable with this, because this is purely coming from, you know, my personal perspective, and that is that I see them as taking baby steps to try and catch up. In other words, they're not really caught up yet. They're still trying to get there. But are those baby steps important for a community of faith? I think absolutely they are. In letting a membership know that you're not, you know, unfaithful if you believe this idea, because we recognize that this happened in our past. And I think that that reassurance alone will go a long way to help certain members who are struggling. But there is a long ways to go, and I think that that's recognized. I don't think that everyone is oblivious to that. But I think that some of the acknowledgments that they've made are very important. I think it's very troublesome to members to find out certain things about, you know, their religious heritage, and then to suddenly feel this guilt that somehow they are unfaithful because they're believing in things that they read most predominantly in what antagonists write about the church. And when they recognize that, no, actually, you know, scholars have been talking about, you know, faithful scholars have been talking about this for generations. I think that there's a reassurance that can come to certain members in feeling that they're not alone and that they're not on the verge of apostasy simply because they're recognizing an actual fact of the historical past. And I think that that alone will have a positive impact on the membership. I know it has with members of my family, quite honestly, which we rarely discuss religion. But when we do, we have talked about it a few times in the context of those statements that are being put out, and I'm pleased to see that family members are reading them and reading them in detail and understanding the details of the nuances of what these things are saying, and that this is giving more information about these rather controversial topics than what they've had in the past, and certainly far more than anything they've ever heard in Sunday school. So I think that that is a very positive step for the church to take, and you know, something that I'm sure is comforting to LDS scholars, that they can talk maybe a little bit more openly about some of these topics without feeling like they're going to come under some type of disciplinary scrutiny.
Right, right. But do you see the church? You know, it's slowly retreating. It's back. You know, we've talked about the fact that it's backed away from who the Lamanites are. It's backed off of, you know, the law of consecration. It's backed off of polygamy. It's backed off of you know, the gathering in Zion and Missouri. It's now backing off the translation. Joseph wasn't a translator anymore, and it, you know, you could say that the church just continues to retreat and retreat and retreat. And do you think this is something it can pull off? Do you think this has some big day of reckoning where the church experiences, you know, not just bleeding of a few percentage points, but like a significant deterioration in membership? Or do you think that it can sort of do what it seems to be doing now, which is this inoculation to slowly, you know, create these essays, to slowly introduce them into the CES, you know, Seminary and Institute curriculum, BYU University curriculum. And over time, members are like, yeah, I was taught about the stone in the hat when I was in high school, and I was taught about the first vision things in high school, and all that DNA stuff, it's not conclusive. And, you know, can you see the church being able to pull this off, or do you see it having a more severe day of reckoning at some point?
Well, ultimately, what I see them retreating from are bad arguments. And that cannot be anything but positive. So in other words, the history has been the history all along. The scriptural texts have been the scriptural texts that they are all along. None of that has changed. It's just that the arguments that have been put forward to present the church in a certain way or a certain light were just simply bad arguments.
Yeah.
And that's what they're retreating from. And so if they're retreating from that and actually turning around to embrace their history, then I can't see that as being anything but positive. And, you know, again, Mormonism is fundamentally a historical religion. The Doctrine and Covenants is full of these revelations issued by Joseph Smith at a historical time and place. They're historical artifacts, all of these documents. So Mormonism can't escape history. So why not embrace it? Embrace it fully and say, this is the way we're going to cultivate a vibrant faith, is by embracing our past, learning from those experiences, and then trying to understand them, how they relate to us and our relationship with the divine. That to me is nothing but positive. And, you know, some members may feel otherwise. Certainly members that are on the verge of fundamentalism would certainly feel otherwise. But I see the retreat from bad arguments as a positive thing, not a negative. And so can the church withstand this over time? I mean, who am I to even begin to say on something on that level? But I do believe that Mormonism is, if there's one thing it's shown throughout its history, is that it is remarkably resilient. It has come back from the brink of death many, many times. And I can't imagine what it would take to bring a movement like that down. It's too youthful, it's too young, it's too vibrant, and it's too resilient. again, I see it as learning from these experiences, and a new generation of LDS appreciating the lessons that are learned and not rejecting them. But that's my take. Maybe I'm being too overly optimistic. I don't know.
Well, I mean, we certainly have the Catholic Church and, you know, dozens and dozens of other religions that are now centuries, if not millennia old, that persist in spite of all this difficulty. So, yeah, so I think there's lots of evidence that Mormonism is here to stay for the long run, you know?
Right, right. And in fact, in your reference to Catholicism is a great analogy. I mean, you look at the new Pope, who, while he's not, you know, some raving liberal or something, some of the issues, from doctrinal issues to social issues, you name it, that he's talked about, it's revitalized Catholicism. It hasn't suppressed it or turned it into something where people are leaving in droves because the Pope no longer is adhering to every jot and tittle of the faith. On the contrary, people are seeing their faith as new and living and a growing faith and not a dead faith, where you're talking about papal encyclicals that are inerrant and can never be changed. And instead, you're hearing a Pope who's talking about revitalization and rethinking and readjusting a mindset of how people approach, whether it be the poor or the gay and lesbian communities. This is something I think that should actually be a lesson to folks, that when it comes to seeing a church being revitalized, change is not the death knell for a movement. It can often be the very thing that breathes new life into it.
Right. So you're almost bullish on Mormonism, it sounds like.
I guess so, and I never really thought of myself that way. So,
one of my listeners commented that it seems like the church is shifting away from evidence towards feelings as the foundation for you know, allegiance, and I'm guessing that you would say that's a smart move.
Yeah, to some degree, and I think the best move is when it comes to religion, feelings are at the core of a movement, and in my opinion. In other words, what does the movement do for you? Does it make your life better? Do you feel a better person because of it? I think going back to what Fiona Gibbons referred to, I believe, as her creed, the notion that I would rather live my life this way because of how my life has been enhanced by this community than to live it outside of this community and not have a richness of life only to find out that there's nothing after life anyway, right? So, in other words, whether there's an afterlife or not, if it's something that enriches your life, if you find a community experience where you belong, then that is at the core of what it means to you. The historical parts of it is that transparency matters, because there's one thing that I've said on multiple occasions, that there is something that will devastate a member more than finding out that Brigham Young ever taught the Adam God theory. And that's to find out that a subsequent apostle or prophet lied about it. That will be far more damaging to them than to find out that Brigham Young taught this idiosyncratic doctrine. And transparency does matter. If there's transparency, then there's nothing to be demythologized, so to speak, in an abruptive way. There's nothing that's so disruptive in your life that your commitment to the community and how it's transformed your life can't overcome. And so that's sort of my take on it. And I would say that with with any community, whether you're, you know, Mormon, Baptist, Catholic, or part of some grand humanist movement. I think that it's how a community can transform your life that ultimately matters.
Right. But yet you're not religious, is that true?
No. And that's fine, because I find meaning in my life and with my family. My family is my community, and my friends around me, they form that communal structure. And there is a richness and vibrance that I find in that more so than I've found anywhere else. And so that's what I gravitate to. That's where I find my fulfillment.
Okay. Have you ever been asked before to speculate on, you know, what the modern apostles and prophets know or don't know, believe or don't believe? And if you have, how do you traditionally answer that question?
Well, I think...
Especially that you've interacted with them so directly, you know that they know quite a bit, right?
Well, let's put it this way. In the case of Marky Peterson, whatever else he may have believed, I know that he knew that Brigham Young taught the Adam God theory because he admitted it to me. And it wasn't like something I had to drag out of him. He just kind of blurted it out when we were in the car driving to his home that evening. And I'm sure that some of the, you know, apostles and so on are aware of some of the thornier issues. Do I believe for a second, like I saw somebody say on one of the comments, I can't even remember where it was now, that they know that Joseph Smith's a fraud, and they're just, you know, perpetuating this for the sake of the corporation, so to speak. And you know, I just don't see that. You know, my dad's been in an upper level church position, albeit on the corporate side, you know, as managing director of temples. I have other family members who are, you know, have held a variety of, you know, church leadership positions. And I just don't see that. Are they aware that there are problems and thorny issues? Yes. Do they believe that secretly believe that Joseph Smith was a fraud? I sincerely doubt that. Could they? Well, of course. I mean, we're speculating after all. But do I think that? No. I've not seen anything in my experience. And again, it's not that fast, but in my experience, I've seen nothing that would lead me to believe that that somehow they know that Joseph was a charlatan and they're just continuing the charade. I don't see that in church leadership. Instead, I see men and women who are very fallible humans trying to do the best they can to handle what otherwise could be a very unwieldy sized organization. And they're doing it with members living globally in a global community where cultures are different and expectations are different. And I think they're trying to do the best they can to manage that and to shepherd the flock of a global diverse community. And I don't envy their challenges. So it's easy to sit here as an armchair interpreter of what they should or shouldn't do, but I don't envy their challenges. And they're going to be seeing many more challenges, I think, in the future, not less. And so transparency again matters. because I think that that will be something that will help ameliorate the pain and difficulty I had.
Yeah. One aspiring Mormon historian asked you, you know, what advice do you have for aspiring Mormon historians? And as a second part to that, what issues do you feel like are most interesting and worthy of exploration? Or has all the good stuff already been, you know, already been explored and uncovered?
Okay, first answer to the first part. Don't follow my example. Do what you can to get an education in a specific area of specialty that you can bring to bear on the topic. Unfortunately, that wasn't my path, and now here I am in my 50s, and I'm certainly not going to think about what other ways I can go back to school and become a freshman to learn something. I've just become an avid reader, and that's where I am in life. So education is important. It can open your mind to a variety of new ideas and thoughts. I've been extraordinarily fortunate to have numerous friends who are very, very well educated and thoughtful people. Some well educated in a traditional sense, some in a less traditional sense. But that's certainly been something that's helped me. As for has everything been uncovered? Heavens no. I mean, I'm giving a presentation next week that involves a document that, to my knowledge, no one has ever referenced before. To a document that we didn't even know exist until the Revelation book was found, and that was thought to be the only copy that survived of this revelation that we didn't even know existed till then. And now there's another one. So, no, there is much more to be done in the field of Mormon studies and in a variety of areas leading into the 21st century, doing historical research and analyses on sociology of religion and so on. There are just numerous areas. But more importantly, you know, I would tell a young budding scholar, never underestimate the power of your creativity to bring a new interpretation to the table that somebody else has not thought about before. Because that simple interpretation could revolutionize an entire thought processes that we've had surrounding a given topic. And never be discouraged. It's just takes a lot of work and a lot of tenacity, but it's worth it if that's what your interest is. I mean, it's worth pursuing. And there's much, much more to the story. Much, much more.
Right. Do you think you could say that it was worth it for you? I mean, we've talked about some pretty difficult times for you, some pretty big sacrifices made in the name of Mormon history. Are you, if you could go back, would you just totally take a different path, or are you still glad you followed it, your passion?
I'm absolutely glad that I followed it. It's how I met my wife Erin, you know, and I love her dearly and tremendously, and that's how we met. And I think about, you know, missing out on that segment of my life is now a horrible thought, but no, I wouldn't want to change it. And what's more, it's not everything was a choice along the way. Some of the things were choices that in some cases led to unseen or unintended consequences. But would I change the direction I've gone? No, because I found it remarkably fulfilling and interesting. Although, if anyone is still listening at this point in these podcasts, they will recognize just how boring this can be. And John, you should have an award that you're giving out to anyone who can say that they listened through all the podcasts at this point in our conversation, because they deserve some type of award of some sort.
No, I think people are really enjoying this series. Well, let's turn to the final sort of part, and I want this to be the hopeful and most constructive part. Like, there are a lot of people out there who are just petrified. They may not believe in the church's traditional narrative, but they may even have a familial circumstance where they could leave the church if they wanted to and not face kind of catastrophic consequences. But there's a lot of people that just have bought into the perception that you can't be happy leaving the church. You can't raise healthy, good kids outside of the church. It's scary. It's too dangerous. It's risky. How do I assemble a set of morals? You know, what do I do with my existential worldview if I don't believe in a God? Does life even have any meaning or purpose? Aren't I giving up too much, not just physically, materially, socially, but existentially to leave? And if I let all that go, what do I replace it all with? And so just why don't you just, if you can, let's kind of close things out today by talking about how you have navigated post-Mormonism in a way that you feel might give hope to people if they feel like that's the path they want to go. Maybe some hope and some tips on how to do that skillfully.
Well, you know, first off, it's funny that I've heard LDS folks actually say to me that, you know, if this isn't true, then, you know, why don't I go out and commit adultery or rob banks and so on? And I mean, I've actually heard people say that. And I've thought to myself, you know, are you in touch with yourself at all? Because the fact is that we're not robots, right? We're not artificial intelligences. We're deeply feeling human beings. And whatever meaning we get in life is going to be self-constructed anyway, based on our empathetic responses to life and others. I think this idea that there is no life outside of Mormonism or no happiness outside of any particular faith is of course nonsense. I think you can find happiness in a variety of areas. But going back to Fiona Givens' creed, you can almost reverse that model too. And that is that, you know, I'm going to live my life to the best of my ability, even not believing in an afterlife. Because whether I believe in an afterlife or not is not going to make it so or not so. It either is or it isn't. And it's not contingent on my beliefs. So I know that in this world that I'm a feeling human being who cares about other people, who finds joy in seeing the joy in other people, and in your children or your family or your friends, it doesn't matter who it is. You know, you don't have to be in a traditional family structure. You can find that joy and love within your own world. And it should never be contingent on what someone else is dictating to you as a belief system. It should be something that each traveler on life's journey should find for themselves. And for those who want to stay within the church, my recommendation is turn it into a symbiotic relationship. You know, I've always had this view that when it comes to a career, that there's really no loyalty to an employer in my mind. And let me explain what I mean by that, just so that that's not misconstrued. Whatever loyalty or semblance of loyalty there may be in terms of a relationship with an employer is one that is purely built on being loyal to my career. And being loyal to my career, I know that that means being honest with my colleagues, being honest with my employer, to be ethical in my work behavior at all times, and to show integrity in the workplace. That's being loyal to my career. And so in that sense, that's where my loyalty lies, because you know as well as anyone else that if you work for a mega corporation, like we both have, their loyalty to you is about as short as your department just got done away with. So there's no reason to be showing that kind of unrealistic loyalty, this unfettered, almost familial affection towards an employer, but rather you treat it as a symbiotic relationship, because ultimately what matters is your career. And so effectively, you know that they're going to give you what you need for sustenance and maintaining life and so on. And in return, because of your loyalty, not to the employer, but to your career, you're going to give them what they expect. And that is integrity, a work ethic and so on. I think that the same would be a healthy relationship with a church, quite frankly. And that is that really what you're loyal to is your spiritual quest, your life's journey. That's where your loyalty is. And so what you're going to do is you're going to, as a result of that, you're going to give your community the most that you can. And in return, you're going to expect the sustenance for your spiritual and life's journey. And if at some point those two don't match up, just like a department being done away with in a corporation, it doesn't mean that life is over or that your career is over, but instead, you simply remain loyal to your spirituality and life's journey, whatever that may be, and you continue on. And that, to me, is where the disconnect often happens when I see people who have been excommunicated from the church, where it has been so disruptive in their lives. They've been on the brink of suicide and so on. And this isn't to diminish anything that they feel, because I get that. I get the absolute trauma of feeling betrayed by a leadership, feeling that the very institution who you thought would be there to support you has effectively rejected you. I get that. But ultimately, it's about you being loyal to your life's journey. And that's really where your focus should be. And your religious or faith tradition should almost be an ancillary product or a vehicle for achieving that. And if it ever becomes, so that it's not a functional vehicle for that life's journey, then make other decisions. But have a path in place, have a plan in place. That's one of the things that I think that religion doesn't really help prepare people for, and that is effectively creating that own unique spiritual space and that own life journey that people can move on and that they can fall into doubt on, but not feel like they've become an apostate, right? Where they can rise up in the ranks but not feel like they are better than everyone else in their community. That's something that I think religion as a whole has a difficult time doing. And in my experience in Mormonism, that religion in particular, I think to elevate themselves above that and for the longevity of the community, teaching people to create their life's journey and their spiritual paths would do wonder for the health of the overall church. And, people are probably going to be listening to this going, wait a second, he doesn't even believe. But I'll tell you, these are things that in my life's journey and trying to understand where I've come from in my religious heritage, those have been the things that have got me through the difficult times. And those are the things that propel me ahead. And that, to me, breeds a healthy interaction with any community within which you may reside.
How do you plug the God hole? Just this security of an afterlife, of a resurrection, of seeing our family again, of an all-knowing, all-loving being that's there taking care of us. I mean, those are some pretty reassuring things when life gets dark.
Oh, absolutely. But on the converse, just because I believe a certain way doesn't make it so. That's for believers and non-believers alike, right? Because I may not believe in an afterlife doesn't mean that there isn't one. If there is, there's nothing I can do to change that. Just like if I do believe in an afterlife or a divine being or whatever the case may be, doesn't make that so either. And so those are things that on my journey, certainly now, I bracket because they aren't going to matter to the here and now. For some people, they may. But for me, they have, in actual fact, not been a source of comfort. They've been a disquieting element in my life. And so for me to not hold on to those ideas now has been, in certain respects, emancipating.
How?
Is that
a loving,
is that
a loving,
how it is?
A loving, yeah, God that's there to help you and nurture you and take care of you? How could it be emancipating and heartwarming to lose that?
Because life's experiences have suggested that either there isn't a loving God who's there to hold me and nurture me, or he hasn't always been there to hold me and nurture me. And I don't know which is the better option, not believing or believing that you're rejected by God. And that's the complexities of life don't always lend themselves to interpreting life as these wondrous, miraculous, blessed experiences. Sometimes life can be utterly brutal and horrific. And to think that a loving God who has the capacity to reach out and hold me, yet didn't in those incredible times of need, is just almost an affront to faith for me. And so for me, to believe in a being like that is not a being I would want to worship. In fact, it's a being who sounds closer to my earlier concepts of the devil than to God. Someone who would sit idly by, who has complete capacity to intervene and does nothing under the most horrific circumstances, the most traumatic, traumatizing circumstances that life has to deal, is an affront to faith, in my opinion, not something that I find comfort from.
What about an afterlife where you get to live forever with your family?
Again, that's not something that, whether I believe that or not, isn't going to matter. So the bottom line is you may as well live every day with those that you care about and with your family as if it is the last day. Let me tell you, our lives would be so much better and a far more wonderful world if we actually took that approach and treated each other with the kindness and love that we would expect to be giving someone if we knew that we were at death's door and that this was our last opportunity to show them how much we loved them, how much we cared about them. I think we would be living in a much better world.
Sure. How'd you feel the spiritual hole?
For me, I guess if there's a spirituality that I have for lack of a better term. It's in a connection that I feel with life, with people, that I have a very difficult time, quite frankly, putting words to. It's something that I feel very real, but some could just say it's, you know, synapses in your brain firing or something, and that's it. But the fact is that they are things that matter to me as a human, because I am a human, feeling human being, and those things matter to me, and they resonate inside of me every day, and that's what I feel. I do have to say, John, in saying all of this, I would never want anyone to feel that I have, you know, gained some greater insight or I found the truth or something like that. I don't feel that at all. But what I do feel is that that I found peace in my corner of the world, and all I can wish for others is to find that same peace wherever it may reside, whether it's within religion, outside of it, you know, or somewhere in the murky area in between. I would just hope that everyone could find their way and attain that peace.
Okay. What about the community whole?
Well, you know, again, for me, it's going back to that model I was talking about of, you know, when the community, like your employer, is supportive and giving you sustenance, then you'll find value there. When that sustenance dissipates, that value is diminished. And so, I mean, to be honest with you, the initial reason why I became inactive from the LDS Church, which was years before I was excommunicated, was because it seemed like every ward I moved into, within a week or two of moving there, I would be called to be the gospel doctrine teacher. And because people would recognize I had an interest in Mormon history and, you know, biblical studies and so on, I'd be called to that position, and within a few weeks after that, I would be having my classes monitored by someone because a member was concerned over something I had said in a class. And quite honestly, I felt like, because of the position I was being put in, I felt like I was more disruptive than constructive, and I felt like their lives would be much better if I just was not participating at that level. And so I remember one of the last sacrament meetings I attended, a member of the state presidency had given this miracle story that it just left me utterly bewildered as to how he could ever understand the story he was telling as being a miracle. And I just thought then and there that, you know, for my own spiritual health and for my life's journey, that there would probably be a better arrangement if at that point in my life I wasn't participating at the level I was. Could that have meant that I may not have participated at some later point? Who knows? We're always morphing, changing creatures. At least I would hope we are. But at that point, that's, you know, just made me decide. I don't think the arrangement I have with the community right now is working well. So in that sense, I have not really missed that part of it. And I found other ways to build other kinds of communities in my life, and I'm fine with what I have. I am more fulfilled by what I have now than I ever was being part of that larger community. But that's just me. Others, I don't doubt, would have very different experiences.
What about raising kids? There are many just petrified saying, how do you raise a good, righteous, moral, healthy kid without the church?
Well, I've done that, and I think my children are remarkably empathetic human beings, and a lot of it doesn't come from the words that we say, but in the deeds that we do. And in saying that, that is not only the good things that we do, but also the not so good things that we do. And that is I have been very open with my children when I feel like I have misspoken or said something that was hurtful at a time that was completely inappropriate. Not that there really is ever an appropriate time for that, but I tell them, and I've been so open with them and said, you know, I am so sorry, that isn't not what I intended. This is what I was trying to get across, and it came out completely wrong. And letting your kids see that you are fallible and on a journey, and that you have things to teach them, but sometimes the things that you have to teach them are from your own errors, not from all the things you do right. Sometimes it's from the things you do wrong. And in my experience with my children, I think I've been incredibly fortunate that they're just amazing kids. And the fact of the matter is that raising kids, it's not easy. And it doesn't matter whether you're Mormon or not. There are kids who are raised in the Mormon church by, you know, good, devout family, and they're completely screwed up. There are others who are raised who are completely well-adjusted, and the same goes for believing and non-believing families. There's no magical formula in my mind that says that somehow by being a Mormon, your kids are going to be raised correctly, or by being a Baptist, they're going to be raised correctly. I think it's what goes on in the home, ultimately, that matters.
How about this, though? How about the logic that you'll have the best chance at raising a happy, healthy kid if you have the support of the church, you know, there for you? That it's maximizing your probability of success by preserving the benefits of community and institution and morality that the church affords.
I think it's so individual, and there are so many factors that go into raising children. The interaction with the community is just part of it. I know, I remember growing up, there was one young man in a ward I was in who was just constantly bullied by all the other males in his age group. And now I think back on that and think, what a horrible, you know, childhood you must have had in your experience within the church. And so I'm just, in saying that, I'm not trying to point that out as that that's somehow typical of anything. I'm just saying that each situation is very unique. And quite honestly, I mean, you know, my son is currently living with me. He's going to college. And he, you know, I'm a proud dad, I'll admit it. But he's remarkable in so many ways, and so thoughtful about the world around him, that I can't imagine what benefit the church would have had to offer over and above where he's at, especially because of how open and tolerant he is of all his friends. He has friends across the spectrum of belief. One of his best friends, you know, he's not a believer, and one of his best friends is an evangelical Christian. And they go out to dinner all the time. They're just, you know, close friends. And, you know, I look at that and go, I'm not sure how the church could have necessarily added to his experience. He's incredibly empathetic towards others. He is completely open to what science has to offer him. He's not going to look at the world through the lens of a doctrinal set of sunglasses, right? Instead, he's going to see the world as it is, the best that he can, and learn as much as he can from the various specialties that he goes into. And so I'm not sure how that would have even necessarily have given him any kind of upper hand more than where he is now.
Does he have any idea what you've been through, you know, what you've sacrificed, what you've experienced? Does he understand the issues sort of underlying all the scholarship that you've pursued? Or is he just like Mormonism is in the rearview mirror for him and he, you know, hasn't even given it much thought or consideration?
Well, I didn't have a full appreciation of this until when I was working for Microsoft up in the Seattle area. We made a trip back to Utah, and he was very unfamiliar with the church, but I remember hearing him ask someone who Joseph Smith was. And that's when all of a sudden the realization set in of how insulated he has been from my experience. I mean, we've talked about God and religion and so on, but we really haven't talked about it that much within a Mormon context. And that kind of clued me in to just how little we had talked about those things in a Mormon context. And I haven't spent a lot of time talking with my kids about past events in my life. They're aware of some things, but not everything. They know that I was a Mormon once and was excommunicated, but you know, not a whole lot beyond that. And they know that I love Mormon history, but it's not a common theme that we talk about at home. Though if they wanted to talk about it, I'm completely open to it. So,
I mean, you know, I think of like how I'm feeling about having been able to interview you. I mean, I've wanted to interview you for probably a decade.
Yeah.
We've been talking about it for at least that long, probably, at least in some manner.
And for people who have been listening to this podcast, they probably think it's been lasting a decade.
I feel like it's been a decade. Yeah. Well, we're almost done. But I, you know, I know how I feel interviewing you. I'm like, this guy's important. He's like historical. Like the things he's been involved in, with, exposed to, the courage, the work, the scholarship, the commitment, the integrity. For me, it's just, it's like this huge honor and this huge, you know, set of accomplishments. I'm just like, wow, Brent Metcalf. You know what I mean? Do you ever, like, that's how I feel, and that's how I know many of our listeners feel. Do you ever kind of wish that your kids, have you ever caught yourself saying, man, I hope someday my kids can go back and read the stories or listen to this podcast and sort of understand what I've been through and the sacrifices I've made and sort of get the road I've traveled to the point where they can go, wow, that's amazing. I'm proud of my dad. I can't believe what he's been through. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, yeah. I guess the way that I would put it is that I think there is, you know, no greater compliment than the admiration of your children. But in all honesty, I think I have that at many levels. You know, I mean, I've heard my son describe me to his friends before as his best friend. And yeah, you know, how can you want anything more than that? There's nothing in my life as interesting as some people may or may not find it that can replace that. And so that's what matters to me. I want them to know that I love them and that will never change. So it's not as important that there's somehow some type of recognition beyond that. I love them for who they are, and I hope they feel the same toward me. So
right. And can you have a happy post-Mormon marriage? I mean, you've talked about Aaron being the love of your life, but, you know, can you really have a happy, healthy marriage after Mormonism? I mean, just for those who are scared about it. I know it may sound like a preposterous question for you, but there's some who are seriously worried that their marriage will dissolve or they won't be able to find joy on the other end if they don't cling to the church.
Well, the bottom line is that marriage, almost by by nature of the institution, is it comes with its own unique set of challenges, and when you throw in unique individuals into that situation, there's always going to be unique and nuanced issues to be dealt with. But I can honestly say that that we, you know, have found tremendous happiness, but more than that is that any unhappiness which we may experience at periods in our relationship have nothing to, would not have changed if we were Mormon or not Mormon. It has nothing to do with that. It's all about, you know, learning to do the interrelationship dance and knowing how to become, you know, a smooth flowing partner in that intricate dance rather than an awkward one who steps on their partner's toes on a regular basis. And that type of thing has very little to do with my faith experience or her faith experience for that matter. And so I think your relationship in a marriage can be as vibrant as you want to make it. And I also believe that, I would say, for someone who's a believer married to a non-believer. I think the non-believer can have just as healthy a relationship with that spouse as the other can have with them. So I don't think that those things are contingent on each other. And in some cases where I've seen it contingent on each other, it's often been symptomatic of deeper underlying issues in the relationship that go far beyond just whether or not somebody's a member or a non-member. And, and the thing is, if someone is, I think respect plays a huge role, and that is being sensitive to each other, because if somebody is a non-believer, if you're constantly belittling the beliefs of your spouse, I don't care whether they're a Mormon or a Democrat, and that's what you're belittling on a regular basis, at some point that's going to take a strain on a relationship, you know, and vice versa. If the believer is constantly belittling, you know, the lack of belief, that's going to be a problem too.
So respect.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's, you know, you've been so patient and wonderful. Our listeners have been so patient. Let's end as I always
try. I think our listeners are asleep by
this
point.
No, I don't think so. I think they're ready for you to bring us home. Just if you don't mind, end with your version of a Brent Metcalf testimony in 2014. What do you still believe? You know, what for you, what is good or what is true? And, you know, what parting thoughts or, you know, feelings or whatever would you want to share with your listening audience who's made it this far? Other than to congratulate them.
right. Hearty congratulations. And as you're drifting off to sleep right now, some final words. I would just say that love and charity matter. And we need to look at each other much more closely and give each other the benefit of the doubt more often. I think that humans are frequently very judgmental in the way they approach others. And one of the wonderful things that I've learned from living in the South is the hospitality of the South. While my politics may not agree with all my neighbors on certain issues, the fact is that their hospitality is remarkable because it shows an incredible willingness to give someone the benefit of the doubt, where, you know, trust is not something that's earned per se, but something that can only be diminished. And that you begin from the point of view of giving people the benefit of the doubt, showing them love and being kinder to others. That to me, those are huge things. And while they may sound like simplistic platitudes, the fact is that they work and they matter. And I don't think we should forget those at any level. I mean, I've already covered so much terrain in these podcasts anyway. I mean, that would be really my closing thought, is that we need to show more love and charity to each other and give each other the benefit of the doubt more often.
And that's actually consistent with both Christ's teachings and the Book of Mormon.
Yes. See, I paid attention in Sunday school.
So here you are bearing testimony of some of the core tenets of the gospel and of the scriptures that we just got through discussing.
Yeah, and I would hope that they would be core tenets of humans in general.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Brent Metcalf, we have an announcement to make, don't we?
Oh, yes, we do. You see, now everyone is definitely asleep. And so go ahead and make it, but we may need to reiterate it on your website here.
No, why don't you announce it?
Well, you know, I'm very thrilled and happy to say that John and I are going to be entering into a partnership of sorts where I'm going to be starting a podcast that will be under the auspices of Mormon Stories Podcast, but that will be called Mormon Studies Podcast. And the hope and anticipation is that we will be getting a variety of scholars in Mormon studies, whether they be LDS, non-LDS, doesn't matter, as long as they are specialists and have provided contributions to scholarship or up-and-coming scholars. We want to get them on, and this is a way of kind of bringing Mormon studies to the masses, if you will, to let people know on a broader level the types of things that are being analyzed, the types of issues that are being debated. And, you know, again, in the format will be very, I'm anticipating, fairly casual, not unlike what we're already doing here. And that is that I'm not there to debate with any guests that come on or anything remotely like that. I basically want to be a conduit for allowing various scholars to come on, express their ideas, and get them out to a broader audience than what a print publication may reach. And so we'll be looking forward to everyone's support on that. And we will be taking donations for the program to help support it, to help support the research that will go into producing the program. And that will also be done through the Mormon Studies Foundation, I guess. And so, but there will be more details on that forthcoming. Is that a good intro to it, John?
Brilliant, yeah. And I'm just, you know, podcasts are hard to do, and lots of people want to do it, but don't, and then lots of people start, and they don't. But I certainly believe in you, and I'm certainly here to support you in it, and I'll do everything I can, and you know, let's just give it a try and see what happens.
Exactly what I think, too. Perfect.
Yeah. All right, Brett Metcalf, bless you for sticking with us. Bless you, all the listeners, for sticking with us. This may be the longest Mormon Stories podcast ever if you string them all together, but for me, it was worth every minute. So please join us at MormonStories.org for the commentary. You can ask Brent questions. Please support us at Mormon Stories if you can financially. Please check out MormonStudiesPodcast.com as soon as we get it up, and support Brent. And just thanks to everyone for all that they've done. And thanks to you, Brent. It's been wonderful.
Same to you, John. Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Stories. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a monthly subscriber at MormonStories.org. Music for this episode was provided by The Lower Lights.
When other sources cease to make